Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Vision of the Godfather of Soul in his twilight years. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and coming up later on today's show, soul singer Angie Stone shares songs from her new album released on the revived Stax record label. But we begin with this year's installment of the Best Music Writing Anthology. It features everything from the maverick brilliance of Beyoncé Knowles to something called Bulgarian Idol. It also includes a profile of James Brown, written by the novelist Jonathan Lethem. We'll talk to another contributor in a moment, but first I'm joined by Jonathan here in our studio and the Best Music Writing Book's guest editor, rock critic Robert Christgau. Bob, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thank you, John.
Jonathan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Was this a case of a longtime fan getting to meet his idol in when you got to do this piece for Rolling Stone?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been listening to James Brown since before I understood that human beings were responsible for those mammoth grooves where they just seem to kind of descend from radio heaven. And then, as my sensibility developed, so to speak, I loved him even more when I figured out that, you know, what he'd invented and when and how much it mattered to all the music I liked.
So it seems like this might have been a dream assignment for you, but reading what is a very lengthy article, there were some kind of nightmarish elements as well, it seems.
Well, I mean, anyone going into that situation in 2005, which I think is the year I was hanging around the recording sessions in Augusta, has had plenty of warning that meeting James Brown is a mixed bag. Uh-huh. And that he's a difficult, elusive, erratic personality. That said, I didn't know completely what I was in for. And the most interesting or surprising part of the experience for me was the way, by going and kind of, coming to the door, basically, of the recording studio, I ended up sort of falling in with the musicians, who are themselves all in this very complicated, abject, fanish relationship to him. They're all slavish devotees. They all grew up themselves listening to the music because
Most of them are in their 30s, right?
By now, most of his band began as James Brown fans, and the only reason they would tolerate this career as opposed to some other career, given their musical chops, is because being his sideman means so much to them that they'll put up with the low pay and the abuse and so on and so forth. So I sort of felt that I was like joining a kind of religious order briefly, and I got to hang out with the nuns, and then every once in a while God in all his abusive glory would show up and put everyone in their place, and then we'd all shudder and be thrilled, and he'd go away and we'd talk about what just happened. And yeah.
Bob, I can see why you were taken with Jonathan's piece, which was called Being James Brown. Now, Jonathan mentions it was like 2005. The book is Best Music Writing 2007.
But everything in it was published in 2006.
Right.
And okay. There were a couple of things where actually it was January of 2007 and we didn't use it. We had to make some changes for just that reason. So it was, and I got to read. The way it works is that the series editor, whose name is Daphne Carr, she reads like 1,000, 1,100 pieces in the course of, over how long a period, months, I'm sure. And then she selects them down supposedly to 90 or 100. It was actually 115. I read 80 of those in one long weekend, Friday night through Monday.
That's a long weekend.
It was. And the thing was, yes, it was hard work, but it was really fun. There were maybe three or four that I really thought were crap. And I said, no, you can't have those in the bank.
All right. Well, I want to talk to you a little bit more about the decision-making process and all that. But Jonathan, you had access to James Brown. That's one thing. But he seems to have taken a little bit of a shine to you. I mean, he allowed you in his presence. Why do you think he invited you into the studio?
Well, there was a feeling, I think, and obviously, once he died, this all seems to kind of make this sense. But But I think the feeling was there that it was a time to put certain things in order. Now, this doesn't mean that he'd calmed down or become a sane or reasonable person, or he was going to open his archives or suddenly apologize to everyone he ought to apologize to. But it did mean that he realized that he should allow himself to be commemorated in certain ways. And they just put up a statue in Augusta, which was something he was very self-consciously interested in. He was hugely proud of it and also terrified. I think he thought it meant he was going to die. But the fact that Rolling Stone wanted to do a major piece on him was not a small moment in this part of his life, because he'd felt shunned by the magazine. And I think he was right to feel that he'd been over the years neglected and shunned by
absolutely. I did some research about that very thing.
And so, you know, I had to first make it clear to him that I felt that he was right to feel that, and that I was going to do everything I could to correct that. I wanted to get him the cover. Of course, it didn't work. The Eddie Vedder was on the cover of the issue where my profile ran, and he didn't get the cover until...
And then six months later, he knocked Ahmet Erdogan off the cover.
Right. Yeah.
So James Brown did not know that you were Jonathan Lethem, author of Fortress of Solitude or Motherless Brooklyn or anything. He knew you as Mr. Rolling Stone.
He couldn't remember my name, and he wouldn't have ever wanted to try. And he didn't pretend to have... I mean, it's not even humbling. It's just very great relief to not have to play it. I'm important in your life, Mr. Brown, because of these things, other things I've done. I was a medium for getting words about him into Rolling Stone magazine, period. So he called me Mr. Rolling Stone.
The him in that sentence being this guy, James Brown. We're speaking with Jonathan Lethem and with Robert Christgau, the editor of Best Music Writing 2007.
If I get there, I've got to win. You need some, so come on and get some. And then you know where I'm coming from. I may lay in the cut and go along, but I'm still on the case, and my rap is strong. Hey! Go jump on my train when I'm out of sight.
James Brown, Soul Power, Part 1. Jonathan Lethem, you actually watched the band do this song with Sam and Dave's Soul Man, right?
Yeah, he's got a medley that he performs in his live show now where he shifts
or
from...
Or did.
Right, excuse me. Yeah. He's still out there, I swear.
He's out there somewhere, probably.
Where he shifts from Soul Power into Soul Man, which is a kind of banal association for him to make. But one of the things he did that was enigmatic during these recording sessions was record things that... wouldn't make sense to release. And he was doing it, I think, to hear himself play. And he got the band assembled, and he loved being in the kind of situation he was in. And I think in a way he was reliving his great moments. So I saw him, you know, cut Soul Power as if for the first time. And at the end of it, he was exhilarated. We all were, because it's an unbelievable song. And he kind of nailed it, and he got very excited as though now it was going to be on the radio and be a big hit.
You know, listening to that record, I mean, the thing about James Brown is that I can just listen to him forever.
Oh, it's incredible.
Because when he died, you know, I had to listen to him forever. I listened to him for an entire week, spent my entire Christmas week listening to nothing but James Brown, and I never got tired of it. As long as I've got the excuse that I have to for work, because I have to listen to other things too.
All right,
it's wonderful. So it's wonderful music.
Bob, you guest edited the book, Best Music Writing 2007. You love James Brown. Jonathan writes the piece called Being James Brown. He loves James Brown, but that doesn't make it a great piece of writing.
Was a great piece of writing. I knew that because I'd read it when I did my own piece after Brown died, which I had missed it, actually, when it came out. They got me the issue. I read it, and I said in the introduction it was the one piece that I was sure was going to be in this book. Because it is an absolutely great artist profile, and I've read thousands of them by now. It's a great
thank you, Bob.
You wrote in the introduction that, you know, you were looking for the best writing, not the best music writing, the best writing.
Well, it has to be about music. But right. I mean, what I wasn't looking to do was to give everybody a chance, to be sure all the genres are represented, to be regional, to include enough gay people or black people, though I think actually there are more black writers in this one than in any other anthology.
So what were you trying to do?
The pieces that I liked the best, the pieces that didn't bore me, that excited me the most. I made one exception for that, and that was a Nick Southall piece called Imperfect Sound Forever, which is about compression, which had sort of put me on the nod. But then I found myself thinking about it 2 days later, and I said, well, sure, it put me on the nod, but I'm still thinking about it and arguing about it and thinking about what it means. So I put it in, and I taught it to my Princeton students in a cultural journalism class, and they said, that piece is a little long, isn't it? I'm glad it's there. It was an important piece, and after I made that decision, I found out that a lot of other people felt the way I did about it. But still, I think that's the one I'm most uneasy about now, because
okay.
It put my students to sleep.
We're speaking with Robert Kryska, who guest edited the book, Best Music Writing 2007. The novelist Jonathan Lethem did the piece Being James Brown. In a moment or two, you'll meet Nisu Ababa, who contributed the piece Making Plans for Daniel. And it strikes me, Bob, that both Nisu's piece and Jonathan's piece are not unalloyed tributes, however much the writers may like their subject. You know, Jonathan, you talk about James Brown's quote-unquote zone of confusion.
I thought Jonathan's piece was an unalloyed tribute. But it was an unalloyed tribute to the actual great genius of American music. I mean, because he also, I don't know, think he comes out and says what I say whenever anybody gives me a chance, which is that he is the greatest musician in the history of rock and roll, and I don't have any doubt about it, but it's what he thinks. I know it is.
Yeah, I sort of
agree with Bob. You might go for Dylan. I know you might.
No. I think, well,
it's close.
It just tells you that there are two different realms,
right.
You know. He's the greatest musician in the history of rock and roll's body. And
that's for sure.
Dylan is the greatest musician in the history of rock and roll's head.
Right.
You know, I'd agree with you, Bob, in that I wasn't – the negative things that I linger over, personal or, you know, or you know, anything in the piece, I'm certainly never breaking any news, nor am I saying, hey, wait, this makes us need
yeah,
to,
but there are
to
theories.
Have
there's,
reservations.
There's,
or,
one, of the,
you know.
One of the things about the profiles I published, every one of them had a critical perspective.
Right.
Maybe with one or two exceptions. There was that piece about the Streisand fans – which I just liked as what it was. It was an Entertainment Weekly piece. It was a great piece about fandom. It was fine.
But for the most part, there is a bit of perspective.
That's right. And so, I mean, you may say you didn't say anything new, but if I'm going to teach James Brown to my students at NYU in the spring, that piece is going in the syllabus because it says a lot about him critically and says it very well in an original way and very – it is a great piece.
Well, thank
but
you.
Nisu's yeah. piece is but, no slouch.
All right. Well, we'll talk to
– No slouch.
We'll talk to Nisu in a moment. We'll take a quick break. The music in the background, James Brown's Sex Machine, he actually – Jonathan, in your article, attributes the bass line to Fred Thomas, who was there in the studio with you when, in fact, most people
right.
know it was
– Bootsy Collins.
Bootsy Collins. Here he is in the background. And so we'll continue our conversation with Robert Kryska, the Dean of American Rock Critics and guest editor of Best Music Writing 2007, the novelist and essayist Jonathan Lethem, and we'll bring Nisu Ababa in with his article about Daniel Johnston. That's all coming up, and coming up later on our program, a live performance in our studio from the veteran soul singer Angie Stone. You can hear her in the background now. She'll talk about life on a new record label that's also a very old record label. And that's coming up. This is Soundcheck.
Speedy motorcycle, let's speed some more. We don't need reason and we don't need logic. We got feeling and we're dang proud of it. Speedy motorcycle.
This This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We continue our look at the best music writing 2007. The novelist Jonathan Lethem told us about his strange encounter with James Brown back in 05. We have Robert Christgau, the editor of the book, with us as well. And also joining us is the writer Nisu Abubba, who is here to tell us about the indie songwriter and visual artist Daniel Johnston. You might know this song, Speeding Motorcycle. This version of it by Mary Lou Lord was used in a Target commercial back in 01. Now, Daniel Johnston's magic marker drawings are almost overshadowing his music career. Nisu Abubba wrote about Johnston for the online news site Pitchfork Media. And Nisu, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Actually, before I ask you about Daniel Johnston, Bob, let me ask you about Nisu and a few of the other online contributors that you put into the book. There are 32 articles, 32 pieces.
Yeah, and eight of them, I think, originated online. And I'm on record as a skeptic about online journalism in general and Pitchfork in particular. But that was, once again, it was the way the cookie crumbled. And it included, I mean, one of my real favorite things in this book is the fake emails that Chris Ryan wrote to Jay-Z on his blog. Which are all in capital letters, and the titles of which I can't repeat on the radio without some bleeps. And, I mean, it's a completely mad thing that no one would publish. But why? Since they're actually great, and everybody I know who's read them loves them. Mm-hmm. So why is it nobody will pay Chris Ryan, who actually works, I think, at Spin, to do this? I don't know.
Well, so do you despair for the state of music journalism?
Not after editing this book, I don't. Okay. I mean, you know, it was heaven. It was heaven to read this stuff.
All right, Nisu, your piece is on Daniel Johnston, musician, artist. 2006 was, you know, according to the New York Times, the year of Daniel Johnston. His drawings at the Whitney Biennial, the documentary, The Devil and Daniel Johnston, about his struggles with mental illness and stuff. So, how did you gain the access that you gained? I mean, in a funny way, there are parallels between your story and Jonathan's.
A little bit. I mean, he's an artist who's, you know, people aren't, he's not sort of out there with the press a great deal. But he had these drawings in the Whitney Biennial, and he was here with his brother to go to the reception. And I think that his family decided that, you know, some sort of journalist should be there and, you know, just say a little something about it. So I got a call one day, and the next night I was standing in a museum with Daniel Johnston.
And what's he like? I mean, is he completely lucid, when you try and talk to him for an article?
He's a friendly guy. He's funny. I mean, I saw him on a night that was very good for him. You know, he was excited about being there, and seemed to be having fun with it. I don't know. I'm sure he has days that are not as good. But he seemed to be doing well then.
And for folks who don't, you know his work, tell us a little bit, what do his drawings look like and why this popularity amongst, you know, the indie rock crowd?
The best way that I could explain it is kind of to start with his childhood. He grew up as the sort of kid who is making lots of art, you know, making Super 8 movies with his brothers, drawing comic books and sitting at the piano and writing little songs. And at some point, for most people, there's some point where you stop doing those things or decide that you need to be more professional about it or something like that. And I don't think he ever had that switch go off. And so, even into his early 20s, he was sitting in his brother's garage with a tape recorder and a chord organ just recording the songs that he wrote. And I think that musically, that was really exciting to people, especially in the 80s when there wasn't sort of this world of being able to access everything. Yeah. Immediately, like on the internet, you could the tape sort of went around to people, and it would be this special thing that you discovered, this guy somewhere in Texas making these little songs. Yeah. The art kind of feels the same way. It's magic marker drawings on notebook sized paper. They have that feeling of, you know, like a teenage doodle, kind of. It's something that's personal in that way,
except most teenage doodles aren't up on the wall at the Whitney, you know, and that his visual art is threatening to kind of overshadow the music.
Certainly is where he makes most of his money, according to Nisu's piece. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's clear to everybody that Daniel has serious bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. He's got a bad case of it. He's a little crazy. Maybe more than a little crazy. And one of the great things about this essay, I'm not a big... to me, Daniel Johnston represents a certain kind of taste for the so-called the marginal, what is the word?
That outsider.
Outsider art. And I myself don't usually share this taste, and I think that Daniel Johnston is absurdly overrated by people who do. But Nisu's piece takes all that into account, still respects him as an artist, talks about why his art is good, and also makes this rather crazy person also seem like an attractive person and really convinces you that he is a nice guy who can be funny, who can make a joke like anybody else. And it's a remarkable job of bringing this mythic and hyper-romanticized in different kinds of ways figure and making him real and respecting him. I reread it to do this show, and I liked it even more this time than I did when I put it into the book.
Let's hear a little bit of Daniel Johnston's music. This is a song, it's a short little ditty called Devil Town.
I was living in a devil town, didn't know it was a devil town. Oh, Lord, it really brings me down about the devil town. And all my friends were vampires, didn't know they were vampires. Turns out I was a vampire myself in the devil town. I was living in a devil town, didn't know it was a devil town. Oh, Lord, it really brings me down about the devil town.
Daniel Johnston, Devil Town is, that is a good example of the art of this outsider musician and visual artist who suffers from bipolar disorder and is the subject of Nisu Ababa's piece on Pitchfork Media called Making Plans for Daniel. Nisu's here with us. Robert Christgau edited the book, Best Music Writing 2007. Jonathan Lethem, the novelist and essayist, wrote the James Brown piece as well. And Jonathan, I mentioned before that I kind of found similarities between Nisu's portrayal of the almost unknown Daniel Johnston and your portrayal of the global icon of James Brown, because both of them have their kind of inner demons and these kind of familial, even if it wasn't his literal family, support groups.
Sure, yeah. Well, one of the things that was very freeing, you know, when I say I fell in with the band, one of the things that startled me was how frank they were with me. And then I realized that they were all telling me everything they felt about James Brown, because they were absolutely certain that James Brown himself would never read the piece. And I thought, this is a very unique position for a journalist to be in. And of course, later on, I saw that he had to actually borrow someone else's glasses even to read a sheet of lyrics that he wanted to sing from, and that reading was just not sort of on his mental map. But it occurs to me now that I might not have been totally alone in that. Did Daniel Johnston read your piece?
You know, that's something that I have no idea still to this day. I assume that his family read it. But yeah, he himself, I wouldn't know either way.
But so his Daniel Johnston's family, they're the ones who've kind of kept him going through all of this over the years.
Yeah, you know, I mean, he's not, as we talked about, he has very severe bipolar disorder. He's not a person who would be living independently if he didn't, you know, have a family who could take care of him. He lives with his parents, you know. Or
the piece is so respectful of that, too, and respectful of their struggle. I mean, it really, it's a very humane piece.
Did you get a reaction from the family?
I don't think I was contacted by any of them. I heard from some, you know, some other people mentioned in the piece who work with them who seem to like it.
So. All right. So Robert, I mean, Robert Christgau, the editor of Best Music Writing 2007, you mentioned before that you are on record as being, you know, not so crazy about online writing. Nisu's piece
it's not edited, although I suspect Nisu's piece was edited. But so much of it isn't edited, and so much of it is people running off at the mouth. What can mm-hmm. I tell you? Because I do a certain amount. I look around online like anybody else when I'm doing my own work, and I find very little that tells me anything I need to know. And I find a lot of stuff that's completely unreliable factually as well.
So
that's
what,
just the case.
But what about the state of print journalism, of print music journalism, where it seems like the venues have become fewer and fewer?
You know, there are pieces here from Entertainment Weekly. There are pieces here from various daily newspapers. And there are pieces here from really small magazines where stuff is published. It's not a good time for anybody who writes for a living to make as much money a word as he used to make for writing from a living. Partly online has done that too, because it's cheapened the value of the word. But in terms of whether that stuff that is out there and there's good stuff, as I said, the reading the pieces that Daphne sent to me, I was absolutely convinced that we were in good shape, because I'm sure I could have found even more. It was a certain point that I did. I went and found about 50. There were prejudices I saw, weaknesses I saw. I went and found other stuff. Wasn't that hard?
Mm-hmm. Nisu, I mean, you work at Pitchfork. I mean, it is an online sort of taste-making website. I mean, how do you respond when people say, you know, it's unedited and therefore...
It's not true of Pitchfork.
Well, yeah.
Pitchfork is edited.
Yeah, Pitchfork, I think of most of these sort of online sources for music information, it's one that is, you know, closer to print and there are people editing. And as the years have gone by, it's become more and more, you know, like a print media might be. I think that the thing about online discussion of music, and I say discussion rather than criticism, is that it seems like a lot of the things that would once have just been conversation about music between individuals are now online and available, you know, on message boards, on blogs. And so it is unedited and often, you know, as you were saying, unreliable in terms of information. But it, you know, it represents what would have just been conversations at shows and things like that before. And it gives people who might not have had access to those conversations can suddenly jump onto the internet and see them, which, you know, I guess does sort of leech away a little bit of the readership for what would have solely been print.
There is, Bob, there's a piece. Eric Davis wrote a long profile of Joanna Newsom.
Right.
In Arthur magazine.
That's right. I barely know what Arthur is, although I remember when it launched, it was sort of a big... Wasn't there Kennedy money behind it? That's what I recall at one point. But I don't have any idea what its status is now. I've never read it.
Yeah,
I know Eric slightly. I know Arthur not at all.
George had the Kennedy money. Arthur, someone else. But anyway.
Oh, George. That's right. It was George that I got that. Not Arthur. Right. You're right.
Right. So what surprised you about that profile?
Well, I hate the second Joanna Newsom. I like the first one, but the second one is, I just can't stand it. And I've listened to that record a lot. And when I saw that this guy who I do know slightly and who went to college with my nephew and who I like a lot, that he'd written this really long piece about this record that I can't stand, I said, oh, God, do I have to do this? And I said, well, don't do it tonight, Bob. Do it in the morning when you're fresh. And get it out of the way. You've got to do it. You've got to be clear-headed. And after breakfast, I sat in my chair, and it's a long piece. 45, 50 minutes later, I was still there. I had not stopped reading it. I was fascinated by everything he had to say. And he painted a really completely attractive person of Joanna Newsom as a person, which isn't surprising. People who make music you don't like can be very nice people. Mm-hmm. Happens all the time.
But it just didn't change your mind about the record.
Not at all.
Bob, you're such a pill. Robert Christgau, the Dean of Rock Critics and the editor of Best Music Writing 2007. A little bit of Joanna Newsom just to kind of finish off things on this portion of Soundcheck. Jonathan Latham, the novelist and essayist, wrote Being James Brown, which is in the book. Nisu Ababa wrote Making Plans for Daniel, about Daniel Johnston, also in the book. And to the three of you, Bob, Jonathan, Nisu, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a lot of fun.
Thanks, Jonathan.
And that'll do it for this portion of the program. Tomorrow on Soundcheck, find out the story behind Vince Guaraldi's classic score to the 1965 TV special, A Charlie Brown Christmas. And coming up in a moment, the neo-soul singer Angie Stone has a Christmas present for you, a live performance in our studio. This is Soundcheck.
From the place where I